Hey everyone, Tom Coyne here with a bonus podcast from the Golfers Journal, presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. It's the sort of week for two podcasts in 1 week for some bonus conversation, because there was a Twitter thread that I read last week and I thought, you know what, we just have to get this gentleman on the program to talk about his 24 reasons why he hates the Ryder Cup. If you already follow Bama Bearcat on Twitter, you'll be familiar with what I'm talking about, his name otherwise. Our friend, otherwise known as Michael Wolf, our friend, golfer, golf historian, works in the business of golf with his company 288 Sports, knows his stuff, about as well-read a person you're going to find in golf. Really interesting opinions. I can't say that I agree with all of them. I'm going to my first Ryder Cup this year. I could not be more excited about it. Michael's been to a few, and he's got some different opinions about what could be better, what he finds to be absolutely awful about the Ryder Cup. So it's really interesting stuff. Again, whether you agree or not, I think it comes from a place with some real knowledge behind it and well-supported points. So enjoy the listen. Enjoy the weekend, everybody. And that's whether you find yourself watching the Ryder Cup or perhaps not. Michael, your point of view is very interesting. And what more interesting guest can we have on Ryder Cup week than someone said that has a conversation on Twitter, a thread that says the 24 reasons I hate the Ryder Cup. Welcome to the podcast, my friend. How are you?
It's terrifying to be here. This can only hurt me. It can only hurt me professionally. Nothing good can come from my appearance in the next 15 minutes.
I applaud the courage. You got to applaud the contrarians, the underdogs, the people who come at you from left field, who don't just give you the same old, this is the week for which we all live. And so I major respect to you for that.
I want to applaud you guys for, having a Ryder Cup preview podcast, because I was worried the week was going to slip by and people were going to forget it was the Ryder Cup week, or that they weren't going to be able to get enough information about this event. So thank goodness there's guys like you doing God's work.
Thank you. No, that's what we're here for, the folks. And in fairness, we dug in with Chandler, our buddy from Hazeltine, a little bit on his experiences there. Some great memories. But your memories, Michael, somewhere along the way of your Ryder Cup experience, I don't know, did they go south? What's the origin of the RC vitriol? I think I said that correctly, even. Was there a moment? Was there an incident? Were you at the Ryder Cup and somebody, threw a beer in your face? Were there insults thrown? Is there a trauma associated with you for the Ryder Cup? Because to find 24 reasons to hate the Ryder Cup, it's deep seated.
I have about 200 reasons, but they would only let me do 24 before I got to the character limit. My first Ryder Cup, I've been to a bunch of them. I've been to like six of them, which brings up the obvious rebuttal from everyone, which on the Twitter, the first rebuttal was, well, if you don't like it, why don't you just not watch it? And why do you keep going if you don't like it? I haven't been in a while. My first one, I was in high school and it was at Muirfield Village, which was a great one to go to, because that was really, if there was a golden age of the Ryder Cup, it was right in the middle of it. The Europeans won on American soil for the first time in a long, long time. And it was the beginning of, the Spanish Armada. And there was a famous 18th hole where Seve hit a terrible putt and then Jose saved his bacon with the tough comebacker that kind of really was the start of their, relationship and stuff like that. But I just remember walking around, there were ropes, but there weren't any grandstands. I got the tickets for free. So I worked at a club in Cincinnati, and the tickets laid on the desk. I think they mailed tickets back then to every member of the PGA got like eight tickets or something, or they could request them. The tickets laid on the desk of the pro shop for at least 2 weeks, and nobody took the tickets. And then the night before or that morning, they said, do you guys want these? Do you want to go? Tomorrow's the last day. And I didn't have my driver's license. I don't think I was 16 yet. So another one of the caddies drove me up there and we walked around and watched the Ryder Cup. I knew what it was, but the tickets laid there for free for 2 weeks and nobody wanted it. So from there to where we are now, somewhere along the line, we've lost the plot line with, I just saw the $12 beers I heard for this week. So we start with $12 beers. It's $175 for practice round. I mean, where do you, I mean, people can read the thread at Bama Bearcat, but we've, it long, long, long ago stopped being about 12 guys from the UK and 12 guys from the United States in a spirit of, you know, the game getting together and meeting each other. I mean, that everybody's heard the joke, you know, the easiest thing to say is, well, they all live in Orlando now. So, you know, why do you pick one or the other? But to me, it's a mix of lost opportunity, of what it could have been. It's too late now to fix it because the ball's gone down the road. It's this weird on many, many levels. And some of them I tried to poke a stick at a little bit with particular tweets and some I didn't, where like, it's just this weird juxtaposition time and time again of like the over commercialization of it on the some hands, but then on the other hand, you're supposed to like it because it's the purest form of the game or something like that, but it's not, because, you know, it's like they it's almost like they want to have their cake and eat it too on many, many different levels. When I say they, I don't just mean the PGA of America, although I've got plenty of beefs with them, but I think PGA club professionals are the hardest working people in the world. And if anybody's going to grow the game and carry us forward, they play a huge role in it. And in many ways, it's one of the juxtapositions is between what the PGA club professionals try to get done every day in their jobs versus what the hell's this Ryder Cup thing turned into. The social media and the media folks, I feel the same way. We're like guys who normally are very data driven and ask great questions. Everybody has just taken this thing hook, line, and sinker. And now it's like, I'm on today because I'm like the only guy out there who's like, this is crazy what's happened. And guys who normally would like follow data and point out other people that are making terrible assumptions, like they're completely willing to throw all that stuff out the window for three matches or four matches over, you know, it's the, you know, the number of reps that happen in a particular Ryder Cup, trying to analyze it post round or trying to, you know, pre-round predict what's going to happen when there's only, you know, so many points available. It's there's some luck and some just roll the dice. You know what I mean? It's not that.
Yeah.
It's just.
So have we abandoned our, essentially what you're saying, we've abandoned some of our better judgment, gotten a little drunk on this Ryder Cup.
A little, well, I'm very drunk. So a big part of it, I would say, that I've seen over the last 25 years is I would liken it to, and credit to them for riding the wave. I mean the PGA of America is much like Clifford Roberts and Herb Wind and those guys realized pretty early on that it was very good for the Masters in the early years, the fact that they scheduled it for the week between baseball spring training and when the baseball teams moved up north. Mm-hmm. That was a way to get all of the reporters to stop in Augusta, Georgia and watch Bobby Jones play golf. And it guaranteed them more publicity than a tournament that was only 1 or 2 years old at that time probably had a right to, and they ran with that. You know, they treated, it was the first golf tournament where they treated the reporters really well and stuff. I feel like it's the same thing with the Ryder Cup, where it's like, it's the last chance for guys to like pump up some numbers and get some activation hits. It's like, we're looking at 5 months of not much going on in the golf world now. So we got to pump up everything we can. And we're going to, you know, there's like a 2 week gap, you know, as well, like between the Tour Championship and the Ryder Cup. So it's like not just 1 week of this crap, but now there's 2 weeks of this stuff that we have to listen to. It's so much hype compared to the actual product. And that doesn't mean the product's bad. Like, I like great match play. Match play is the greatest form of the game, but the build up to it from everybody, the fans, the media, everybody. And then at the end of it, the dirty little secret is the players don't care. They don't care as much as everybody else does.
They don't care. Okay.
You know what? When I took Latin in high school, when I was taking those Latin classes in high school, I really, really cared. During the 45 minutes that Latin test was going on, I really cared. Did I care about Latin? No. I cared about passing that test. And that's where these guys, that's the feeling. It's me in Latin class in high school. They got to get through it. Of course, if they got to be there anyway, they want to win. Of course, when Rory's two down to Patrick Reed, he wants to beat that guy. You know, these guys are apex predators. You know, they're born and bred to win. But in the grand scheme of things, does it matter that much? No. So
you don't think, I mean, obviously there's
a game. It matters to the guys, curiously enough.
Some guys, it seems to matter.
It does. And I think it's an interesting psychological thing. It seems to matter more to the guys whose careers, I don't want to say failures, because if you make the Ryder Cup, you're a great player and you've had a great career. It seems to matter more to the guys who have come up a little bit short. You know, if you look at Sergio, or you look at Ian Poulter, or you look at Colin Montgomery, or you look at from the American side, you look at Azinger, you look at Patrick Reed these days. And I know Patrick Reed's not playing this week, but there's a lot of that list. There's a lot of guys who probably thought they were going to win three or four majors, and they won zero majors or one major. And maybe this is a little bit of a way to salvage at the end of the year, or you know, they feel like they've got a little bit something they want to show. And if you look at Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods and, you know.
What about Seve?
Well, that's a hole in my argument. But with that one, I will give myself an out and say, I think that those three or four years in the middle there of those late 80s, early 90s, they all felt like they had something to prove, because that was the last time when they really were kind of two different tours, and there was a little animosity for the younger folks. You know, Seve, he felt like he was the best player in the world, and they wouldn't let him come over here and play golf unless he kind of bent his knee to what the PGA Tour wanted as far as a full-time commitment from him. And that rubbed people some wrong way. And there was also, I think, the crop of players that Seve and Faldo and Sandy Lyle and those guys went against. They also, like, they carried themselves with like a special kind of arrogance that was unearned. Like, you watch those like old tapes and stuff, and like the way they talked, and like, it was amazing. Like I say, Azinger is my number one guy. Like, you listen to him talk, and you think like he was undefeated in his Ryder Cup life, and that he'd won 10 major championships. You know what I mean? He was a terrible Ryder Cup player. He only won one out of every three matches he ever played. His professional career, I mean, he won a major. That's certainly that kind of accomplishment, but he wasn't Seve Ballesteros, and he wasn't Nick Faldo. And I think the Americans, they felt like they were. And I think if you're Nick Faldo and you've won six, and you think, who the hell does this guy think he is? Like, saying he's, you know, that they're the favorites this week. Like, you know, I could see why they felt like that. But I think that was real brief. That to me was a 2 or 3 year period, and they didn't know each other as well back then. That time has passed. Now it's we're just getting some TV ratings and selling some merch, and it's a week. It's like, it's cotton candy. I mean, watch it. It's fine. I also say, I didn't put this in the tweet. I wish it had been my first tweet and on the thread until I had a room in a room. It's the best time of the year to play golf, people. Like, we're about to go into darkness. It's about to get cold and rainy and wet. Like, go play golf this weekend. Don't sit on your couch for 14 hours on Saturday and watch an event that I promise you care about more than many of the people that are involved in, or at least they won't think about it when it's over. Go play, man. Go play 18 holes. Call your dad. Get him out for a round. You know, before it gets cold. when it gets to January or February, we're gonna think, man, like, why wasn't I playing back in September on that weekend when it was 77 degrees and it was beautiful and there was no humidity? It's crazy that like the schedule of this thing is crazy too. Like, it's the worst possible time of the year to have it.
Well, some of us are, you know, some of us will be at the Ryder Cup. Yeah. I'm pretty damn excited. It's the first one. It's my first. So I'm glad we're having this conversation. You're pulling back the curtain on some things here, Michael.
I love the enthusiasm. The enthusiasm there is great. Go. I mean, it's worth seeing. I'll say this. Like, again, this sounds crazy. If you read my Twitter thread, everybody should go once. It is one of those things that you should see. I've been to a bunch of them, and I followed. I'm a grumpy old guy now, 50 years old. Whenever to get off my lawn. But when you also go, like, it also, at least for me, my background is a CPA, like, then it also leads to, like, where's all this money going? Like, wait, they're getting $12 for beers, and it costs $175 for a practice round, and they're selling a lot of tickets. Like, it's jammed. Like, I mean, there's 30,000, 40,000 people there a day. And you start to do the math in the head of, like, well, if the average ticket price is $400, and there's 30,000 people here a day, and everybody's buying $210 golf shirts in the merchandise tent, like, that's $250 million, and the players aren't getting any. So where's all the money going? And the caddies aren't getting any.
Right.
Now the wives are getting money for the dresses, so that's great. But where's all the money going? You know, I kind of wonder that too.
Well, that's a good question, because I think a theme that runs through your tweets is this sort of notion of the commercialization balanced with the lack of support for PGM programs, etc., other things that the PGA could be spending their money on. But the PGA is, you know, the people who work for it, I mean, no, they're not getting, you know, PGA members that work at the PGA, some of who have been on this podcast, are, you know, not a high salary kind of, you know, employees, right?
Right. Yeah.
So I can't tell you where that money
is going, but presumably it's going into the support and development and resources for the people who, you know, you started off by saying are the hardest working people in golf.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a PGA Tour event. It's a PGA of America event. Club pros versus tour pros, for people who aren't familiar with the difference. So they're making a lot of money. How would you have done it differently? They have a product here, right? That's successful.
I've heard asset. They use the word asset a lot.
It is an asset.
That drives me crazy. About somewhere around 2005, I think, is when it became an asset. Not a celebration, an asset.
Okay.
Everyone
calls it, but what are you going to do with it, knowing that it does well, that it can make money? And if you do something, if you promote it more, if you put more into it, you can get more out of it. Isn't it their responsibility to do that for the organization?
There is. And they have to, because one of the weirder things about this game we love, especially professional golf, is that it's crazy, but the most publicly public of the professional golf, you know, the one organization that's tailored to running professional golf tournaments is the PGA Tour. And yet they don't control any of the five biggest events in golf. You know, the British Open. Yeah. And so there's always this weird conundrum that whether you're the USGA or the RNA or the PGA of America, you've got to kind of make enough money from your one time to finance a lot of your other stuff. And with that comes opportunity. But it also comes with, I think, kind of an obligation to your members. And if you're the USGA, you can point to, hey, we're funding 16 other championships, and we've added four ball championships, and we've added U.S. Senior Women's Open recently, and we're trying to do stuff with equipment testing and, you know, all the stuff that they're going to do down in Pinehurst and stuff. And it just seems like they're a little bit more public about it. And with the PGA of America, it's just kind of like, where's it all going? Because I know a lot of hardworking pros, and their lot in life doesn't seem to be much better than it was back when the Ryder Cup was a $20 million affair instead of a $300 million affair. You know, the same kind of basic issues that they have. And if anything else, there's a lot more places, at least where I live, in the PGA section where I live, where there's not PGA of America people even working at the golf clubs anymore, like the clubs. They don't even have PGA professionals anymore. So like, it's, you know, I feel a little bit, I don't know, sorry or whatever. It's like, man, that seems pretty important to me. Like that. So what?
Fair point. And sure,
it's a black box. Yeah. I'll never know. It's not my business. I don't have anything to do with it. And it's, I'm sure everybody's working hard. There's no easy answers, but I do believe as a businessman, there's also a little bit of like, man, if you're going to be ruthless about the way you do business, like we're going to fire a whole bunch of good people down in Florida and move them all to Frisco because we got a bunch of tax incentives, and we're going to cut bait on Port St. Lucie Golf Club that we ran and ran very unsuccessfully. You know what I mean? But then we're going to turn right back around and charge you $12 for a beer. Like, seems like if you charge $9 instead of 12, you know what I mean? Like, we're going to get every dollar out of every inch of the Ryder Cup that we can, except for the players. Them, they're going to play for free, because if they don't, they're not good Americans. Like, that seems a little bit like, wow, you know, like, okay, well, if you're gonna behave like that, that's fine. You're behaving like a Fortune 500 company in America does. But if you are, you better deliver the results. And if you don't, then I don't feel bad about saying, what the hell is going on here? Or, you know what, I think I'm gonna go play instead of watch it this weekend.
Fair enough. And transparency is good. And there could be better communication, maybe, that where this sort of, you know, this financial juggernaut that we're portraying it as, what, you know, comes of that, of those monies. But, you know, also in fairness to the PGA, there isn't some, you know, round table of billionaires, in Frisco, who are padding their pockets with, you know, with Ryder Cup money. Or I'm not aware of one. So where it's going, I don't think either of us know. But I don't know. I don't think that there's anything sort of nefarious or anything where anyone is getting rich off this Ryder Cup. I mean, this is an organization that exists for its members. Now, like you say, but you bring up good points. I mean, could they be doing more?
I don't think it's nefarious. I think it's just a runaway freight train that they had this thing and it exploded, and it benefited them. And so they were kind of willing to kind of go along with it. And I think the media was the same way. It's, you know, it's an extra 2 weeks of content for the media at the end of the year when things were going to be really slow. And so most of the media members were willing to just kind of go along with it as well and not yeah. ask any of the hard questions or ask like, even is this like whatever. It's nothing like that. I don't think anybody's stealing money or anything like that. I think it's just, for me, it's like, it's partly like, just I'm not gonna be sold on it just because everybody else says it's awesome. I've been to enough of them. I know it's not awesome. It's like I went to the quarterfinals of the I flew up to Washington D.C. because I wanted to watch Rose Zhang play in the girls' junior amateur. I thought that was a really good story that she had won the amateur before. She was trying to become the first person ever to win the junior amateur before she won the amateur, or to win the junior amateur after she won the amateur. I thought that was real golf history. And so I flew up there because I wanted to see it. I was standing 10 feet from Rose Zhang for most of the match. Like, you could walk right there. Like, go do that. Like, take your son or daughter to a USGA event or to your state amateur championship and walk down the middle of the fairways 15 feet behind them. Don't wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning to sit on the first tee, you know, of a 12,000 seat arena that's been constructed so you can watch 24 people hit golf shots. Like, it's
like a party, man.
Well, yeah. Or do it and just have it as a party. That's fine too. But if you're gonna have it as a party, then don't try to sell me on it as like golf history. That's the other thing. I mean, like, another thing in my thread, like, is what's the lost opportunity of it? Like, this is the one event you could have anywhere. I was down right before COVID. I was fortunate enough to be down in Australia. I got to play several times at Royal Melbourne, and they were still just beaming about having how well the President's Cup came off at Royal Melbourne. And one of the main things that they all told me was, like, they played our course. Like, it was really cool to see, you know, the top professionals in the world play our course from our tees. They didn't add a bunch of new tee boxes. You know, they didn't play it from 7,900 yards because they didn't have to, because it's all match play. You know what I mean? And that's like, so why are we bothering to, you know, eliminate golf courses that we could potentially use? You know, you can't have a U.S. Open at Myopia Hunt Club. You can't have a U.S. Open at a lot of great, you know, Chicago Golf, probably not. But man, you could have match play there. Is the answer because you can only have 25,000 people there for $300 a pop instead of 30,000 people there for $300 a pop? Because if that's the answer, then I don't think that's a very good reason.
That's very interesting there in terms, and your thread does get into that as well in terms of venue selection, and that I'll definitely concede you the point there that some of the choices with venues, it seems strange that you know, when it goes to Europe, that we don't get to see it on great classic links golf courses, and then when it comes here, you know, sure, that we get it at an American version of a links golf course is a little bit, you know, but who knows the negotiations and money, etc., that goes into picking these venues.
They are maximizing an asset. Is there a legal right to? Good, right, for them, as long as the money's going to a good place. But
who says in terms of maximizing assets, couldn't one say that about Augusta National, about the USGA?
No, goodness,
you don't think so?
No, Augusta National, a beer is $3.
Fair point on the concessions, but the experience has changed quite a bit from, again, you know, I have some friends who've been going for, you know, 40, 50 years and now go and feel like it's a Disney World experience because of the new shopping center, the new this, that, and the other. I think it's great. I think it's actually quite a nice place to get souvenirs and easy.
They spent a whole bunch of money down there so everybody could park for free.
Yeah, very good point there. Okay. And you wouldn't say that about the USGA and the US Open?
I mean, maybe the US Open, but I like what it started with Mike Davis, but from what I understand, they're going to continue, which is kind of they're going to deal with the economic realities that the Open needs to be a cash cow for them by having basically a rota for six or seven rota sites spread out geographically. And then what Davis said was, and some others have said, is that will also enable them, though, to every 10 years or so take a chance at some other place where they won't be able to sell as many tickets. See, I think I don't want to try to quote them word for word here, but the point was, is if we can make enough money on some of these big sites, you know, big 36-hole facilities like Wingfoot LAC and LACC and places like that, where you can get big crowds in and stuff. Yeah. Then that one up was to go to a Marion every 10 years or a Brookline, where we otherwise wouldn't be able to go, or a public course for the first time, where we know we're not going to be able to be as financially profitable, but at least we'll be, able to do that. And what the USGA doesn't do is they don't let a guy walk in to Far Hills, New Jersey with a checkbook and buy a US Open. That's what happens at the Ryder Cup. I mean, it's you build a new course, you want to have a Ryder Cup. You can have a Ryder Cup in 5 years, I mean, 10 years. I mean, it's,
yeah. What's the reaction been? I didn't go through the responses. I just looked at, you know, your 24 reasons, which you said could have been more. What was the general reaction from the golf Twitter sphere?
That I woke up on the wrong side of the bed and that I'm a grumpy old man, which are all true. it builds, you know, it's just the little things. It's more of the, like I say, it doesn't bother me personally. I mean, I don't have to watch. I certainly don't have to watch. It's just a little bit of the, like, it's gotten so big that even when people say, well, like, don't watch, it's like, I don't, you know, don't watch the Super Bowl either. But like, it's kind of hard to like ignore when it gets shoved down your throat. Just so much about like how great it is. And then I also do feel a little bit sorry for some, not sorry, but like, I do think that there's like some, I fancy myself a little bit of a golf historian. I read a lot of books and I like to pay attention to kind of the big picture in golf, I think sometimes. And it is unfair in many ways. I think if there was any of the tweets that I really kind of, that I meant, or that I think should be taken seriously, it is that like statistical, the way it's presented on TV and then the way it's packaged and repackaged forever. And maybe that's just, maybe this is just what the price you pay for being a big time athlete, but like nobody realized the tweet that I sent that Justin Leonard didn't win any of his matches at Brookline. He played four matches and he didn't win any of them. But most people, I mean, I think even pretty observant golf people would think that he was the hero of Brookline. I don't think many people could tell you that Tom Kite was the greatest singles player in Ryder Cup history. You know, I mean, there's no correlation between how they play and how they're remembered in history. And for some of the guys, I think that's unfair. I don't think it's fair that I don't know how you change it or how it would be any different. I guess that's part of being in a team event is, you know, you can score 35 points in a basketball game, but if you miss the free throw with 1 second left, then you're the one who blew the game. I guess that's just how it works in sports. But for me in particular, because these guys are individuals and they're like coming together as a team once a year, it seems pretty brutal that a guy can be remembered, you know. So one player goes out and gets beat 6-5 and he's never on television and people don't even remember the next day that he got his ass kicked. But a guy plays really well in a tough match and it comes all the way down to 18 and his last three holes are on television and he misses a putt on 18 and he's the one who blew the Ryder Cup. You know, yeah. It's like, man, that's tough. Like, and I guess that's big time athletics, I guess. But for me, it's like, whew, that's,
it is.
That seems, you know, when it you is. Said it in the focus of history, when you like look back on some of these records and like I say, Azinger, he was a terrible Ryder Cup player. You know, he struts around now like he's got all the answers to Ryder Cup success. It's like, oh man, you sure didn't know that when you played because you got whipped a lot. And Tom Kite, nobody's going to ask Tom Kite this week, like, what should the U.S. do to win, do better in the Ryder Cup? he was an animal in singles. 7 matches he never lost.
So, I mean, but yeah, I mean, sports, the nature of sports, they're about the moment.
Sure. It's entertainment. This is entertainment.
Right.
This isn't history. This is not history. It's just entertainment. It's cotton candy.
But I'm glad that we had a chance to talk with you, who you have a longer, you take the long view on this stuff as someone who is really into golf history and how the Ryder Cup fits into that. I think you would suggest that it probably doesn't. Not to put words in your mouth, but that there are, you know, other.
There's no correlation. There's no correlation at all between a player's performance in the Ryder Cup versus his standing historically as a golfer. And they know that. The top ones know that. I mean, the real Jack Nicklaus and those guys, they know. Tiger knew. You could tell. Didn't mean he didn't want to win that week, but he didn't build a schedule around it. He didn't, you know, it's just they all want to win, but it wasn't the most important thing in his life. For most of them.
Well, Michael, I'm glad that, you know, the time and the thought and the research even that went into this thread, it's really interesting. I'm glad as well that I think we can agree on the idea that it is entertainment. For me, it's kick-ass entertainment. I can't wait to be in that environment and feel that energy, even if it is the product of marketing manipulations, and is not the organic product of sheer passion from, you know, one team of golfers versus another. I'm cool to be on I'm excited to be on a pretty hyped up golf course. And
yeah, it's different. You know, I'm hopeful. I've heard good things. You know, I think the folks in that part of the country have a great reputation for enjoying golf and being passionate about sports in general.
For sure.
Without getting crazy. So I think that's good too.
Yeah. So you're going to be watching.
So I like, okay. So I'll completely flip down after talking to you for 20 minutes.
And you just said to go play golf. So you're not allowed to watch.
Well, but here's what I do like about the Ryder Cup, which is it is a rare chance for people at home to watch a player in the early rounds, in the early matches. I do really like, and I think it's good for people to watch, see the whole match, you know, because there's only four matches going on, you know, at a time. Friday morning, four matches going on. So they show every shot of every match. And on TV, they usually do a pretty good job with the Ryder Cup. And that's pretty informative for people. I think most people, I get to go to a lot of professional golf tournaments, and something I tell people all the time is like, what you see on Sunday afternoon is not like what a real golf tournament looks like. Like if you go on Friday afternoon, you follow some guy who's, you know, struggling to make the cut line, and you watch him all 18 holes and how he works it away around the golf course and just figures out a way to hang on and shoot 69 instead of shooting 77, like a scratch golfer would when he's not on his best game. That's the part I kind of like. And I think that the Ryder Cup is kind of a rare opportunity to get that, where you see a guy who's like, he's just hitting it all over the map, you know, for the first four or five holes, and his partner's just kind of trying to keep him in it and have him and, you know, stay one down and not go two down or not go three down.
Yeah.
And then somewhere along the line, it kind of the script flips. And then, you know, the guy who was playing good at the beginning starts to not play as good, but his partner catches fire. That I do like. I do find that part interesting and worth viewing.
Hey,
will I be watching 9 hours of coverage on Saturday? Probably not. It's going to be a nice day here in Birmingham, Alabama. The humidity is gone. I will probably be on a golf course somewhere. So,
but let's end on a little, that positive note, little positivity that we got there. I agree. And it is a pretty cool thing to be able to watch an entire match and see how it unfolds. And if you want to, and if you're inclined like me, well, the weather, you know, anyway, I'm going, but even if the weather's like nice, I mean, that I always enjoyed those Fridays and Saturdays, just where I knew you could not be bothered. Don't knock on the door in my office here. I'm watching the Ryder Cup because I believe it matters, even if it's just because someone's telling me it does.
Okay. The best way to view it, by the way, real quick for your guys, because I'm a big fan of the stuff that you do. So this will fit right in with your books. The best way to watch the Ryder Cup, and I did this once by accident. I didn't realize the date's overflow. So the best way is for you and your buddies to schedule, if you live in America, schedule your buddy's golf trip to Scotland or Ireland the week of the Ryder Cup. Because you can, when the Ryder Cup is being held in the United States, you can play golf all morning. The golf courses are usually pretty empty because everybody else is getting ready to watch the Ryder Cup. And you can finish just in time to go back, take a hot shower, and then you can watch the Ryder Cup at night while it's dark over there. And you can watch it in the pubs with all the European guys and see who they're cheering for. So, 4 years
Ryder Cup in prime time. That's pretty,
4 years from now when it's at, where is it? At Bethpage next time in the United States, go to Ireland and watch the Bethpage Ryder Cup from Ireland.
I love it. Michael, thank you so much. Hey, we should also say, folks who just listen and then at the end of this, we're like, Michael Wolf knows a lot about golf and golf history. Give us your bona fides. I mean, you're involved in the game. Tell us about 288 Sports.
I represent some professional golfers, mostly more as like a business manager. My background is a CPA, but my golf is from my love of golf history came because I couldn't play golf. I loved golf. I was a caddy when I was 12 years old, and then I got sick kind of in my adolescent years, and I wasn't able to play golf for a number of years. I was in the hospital. So my parents, because people would say, well, like, what can we do to keep him busy? They said, well, take him golf books. He likes to read about golf. And so for a couple of years, I did nothing but read golf books and not play. And then after I felt better and I started traveling quite a bit for work, I had an opportunity to go play a lot of the golf courses that I'd read about. And it's been fantastic. It's the greatest game in the world. You know, anybody, old person can play with a young person. You know, an 18 handicap can play with a scratch, and it's the greatest game. Exercise, fresh air, you get to see the world, you meet people. Your books that you've written are the, you know, everything about them is why I, you know, if I could write, I would have written one of those books that you wrote.
That's exactly how
I feel about it. It's the journey and the people you meet along the way. So awesome. Today it's more of a, I do some collecting of the books themselves. I like to try to find the old ones and learn new stuff. And I do some volunteering with the State Golf Association and the USGA. So I do enjoy giving some time back. I feel like I try to put my money where my mouth is a little bit as far as volunteering as well. I don't just complain all the time. I do try to give a little bit back. It makes me feel a little bit better when I bitch about stuff. So
we have a lot of friends in common. I know you do a lot for golf, and it's been awesome to talk with you. And
we might have some enemies in common. Thanks, Tom. No, we got to play some time.
We do.
I feel bad. I missed you when you came through Alabama.
That was a short stop. Yeah. But I've got to come. So I have to come back to Alabama. But we'll do that. But thanks so much for your time. I don't know what you're going to be doing this weekend, but enjoy it. Whatever you're doing.
Golfing. Play golf, people. Right. Play golf. Get some
play golf, America.